This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Green.
So last Rivas Hernandez was reported missing three times in 1 year while she was allegedly having some form of a relationship with artist David. She was 13 the first time she allegedly ran. Some reports say that it might have been even earlier than that. By 14, she was allegedly living inside a Hollywood Hills home with a rising music star, 7 years older. The charges against David Anthony Burke are horrific, but the part of the story that should terrify every parent listening is everything that happened before. A child disappeared into a celebrity's world and nobody stopped it. That's where we're going to be. Again today, your thoughts, drop them in the questions area in the comment section on Substack, YouTube, Facebook, X, wherever you're watching us. Siobhan Scott, psychotherapist and author, is joining myself and Robin Drake, retired FBI special agent, chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program, as we dive deep into the mind of David Anthony Burke, known as David. Siobhan, let's start here. Burke's friends thought Celeste was 19 and in college. At least that's what they're telling everybody now. She had fake IDs. She was at clubs. There are people saying she fooled everyone. Why is that such a dangerous narrative in this case right now as we try to understand who knew what and when, that she fooled everyone?
Yeah.
This is someone who was a child.
Yeah.
Yeah, let's just start there.
Go ahead. I call BS on that yeah. Everybody thought she was older. You know, she doesn't look older. She looks like a young adolescent, which is what she was.
Yeah.
In the, you know, the live stream video that we saw of the two of them together, she presented as a little girl. Mm-hmm. And I think everybody's just trying to cover their own butts at this point. Oh, we didn't know, we didn't know, we didn't know. And I just don't buy it. I think it's self-serving.
And it also doesn't matter in the law either. I mean, it doesn't matter. Yeah. Her age is her age. And so they can rationalize all they want, but it's still illegal.
Yeah.
The verbiage and the stories that are coming out here, we're hearing, oh, her other boyfriend said this, and she's a 13-year-old girl. Like, how many boyfriends has she had? What kind of experience is going on here in life? And that's an interesting thing about this case, because from what we understand, it seems that this girl didn't necessarily grow up in the best of environments. She's running away multiple times. That's a whole other conversation. What's inspiring her to constantly run away? But the fact that she kind of had, from what we understand, a hard life, probably grew up a bit faster than everybody else, maybe did act a bit more mature than her age. But that seems to be such a thing with this case. And unfortunately, with young people who end up having to mature before their actual age says that they're old enough, they carry themselves differently. They carry mm-hmm. themselves with a little more maturity. And it seems that the adults in the room around don't recognize that, or they recognize it and they accept it when they really shouldn't. Nobody should be looking at a 13-year-old girl and going, oh, well, she's just more mature for her age, so we're just mm-hmm. going to treat her like an adult going mm-hmm. forward. Mm-hmm. That's not okay. That's never okay. And I don't care who you are, especially the parents shouldn't be treating her that way. But it seems everybody in her orbit was treating her that way.
Yeah, and that's, you know, one of the things, I'm not knocking all men, of course, but I remember being 12 and having predatory 30-year-olds, you know, trying to give me rides home from school. Mm-hmm. And it's very seductive when you're a young teen girl and you're surrounded by predatory men. Yeah. Who will always say, oh, but you look older, you act older, you seem more mature. And as I've talked in my book, I met my first husband at 15 and he was 25 and, you know, and married him shortly thereafter. And one thing I heard from so many people, well, it's okay because you're so mature. And it wasn't okay. And it was pseudo-maturity. You know, it was all a facade. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a problem in our culture where there's a certain subset of men who go after young girls because they have so much power over them, and kids can be easily manipulated.
Yeah, I keep getting fixated right now on that word maturity that everyone keeps using with her. And Siobhan, from your amazing book, from your background experience, mine to a much lesser degree, I think what happens is, and as I'm curious about if you agree, in using that word maturity when you're referencing someone who's so much younger, 13, but went through a lot of trauma and has a lot of reps in problem solving. In other words, I think people are mistaking someone's ability to problem solve because they face so much trauma, they face so many challenges in life that they and no one to rely on, no one to help them feel safe, no one to help work through it. So they're very adept and have life skills at solving problems to be safe, which looks like someone else who wants to manipulate their own mind and rationalize it as, well, they're just mature. No, actually, they're problem solving the chaos in their lives. Is that accurate?
I think that's a really good point. They gain some skills in survival. And so they may at times speak in a way that seems more sophisticated than a 13-year-old. Some 13-year-olds are still playing with Barbie dolls, you know, and others are out walking in the street and getting rides home from predatory men and presenting themselves as older. But it's not insight. It's not real maturity.
Right. And so you can imagine how someone with that skill set, because they come from such a horrendous background, challenging background, especially learning how to travel on your own across a country as a 13-year-old, and now you're presenting to a group of adolescent moron boys that haven't problem solved anything in their lives. You know, they know how to go on TikTok. They know how to make music. You know, it's like apples and oranges. And so it's easy to see how she looks so much different to them because they're idiots.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, I used that word completely.
Well, it's so much nicer to say, oh, you're so mature for your age, rather than saying you're so traumatized. Mm-hmm. You have so many unnatural survival skills.
Yeah. I mean, that's the first thing you do when you see someone that presents at such a young age with that kind of problem-solving skill set. The first thing that pops up in my mind is, what's going on in your life that made it that you needed that skill set? Because basically, we only do things we need to do. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily at that age that you want to do. So, and there's the failing. So I'm going to, I know we're poking at Celeste's family or lack thereof in intervening. Well, what same thing on David's side, you know, what the hell, where is the parental oversight on this side saying that we're us as parents are seeing the red flags go up and say, what the hell is this?
Very much.
This, yeah. You need to distance yourself from some crazy here because there's some craziness going on in this life. And you're not the age or in the or have the disposition for an underage minor to be a lifesaver.
Mm-hmm. Oh, mm-hmm. there's red flags and questions and utter failures of parents all around in this case, it seems. She ran away three times. Let's get into that. Let's talk about her home life a little bit here, what we know or don't know about it. She was 13 and has run away three times. Mm-hmm. Her ex-boyfriend allegedly has said that she was unhappy at home and talked about leaving. The fact that a 13-year-old's even thinking, hey, maybe that's an option. Maybe I should leave. I mean, that's not good in any way, shape, or form. Why? What is a kid that age actually chasing when they keep running? And why is that the exact thing the wrong person knows how to offer?
Yeah, you're hitting on something I think is really important. It's just hard to know what her home life was because, you know, there's one factor that I don't know, and people may be talking about it. I'm not sure at this point. There are kids from very good homes who are seduced by predators online, and I see that happening so much. And it's really easy to confuse a 13-year-old or a 10-year-old. It's happening with such young kids. And I always say I have such compassion for parents who have kids, and all kids are on the internet, right? Mm-hmm. And it's really hard to monitor what they're doing. The kids can get around that parental control software. And I've seen even in very stable, wonderful families, a kid gets hooked up with a predator on the internet and they're manipulated and they may take off. And we don't really know, just because we don't know the family, we don't have enough information. Was she running to something or was she running from something?
Great point.
And kids at 13 often hate their parents. I mean, you know, they just do. My kids, when they were 13, thought I was the dumbest person in the world. Fortunately, they grow out of it, you know, but.
Good.
Well, they do. Yeah.
Siobhan, you make such really powerful points there that I think people got to keep remembering on this, and including us. You know, when I was working with the Innocent Lives Foundation, we had one of our victims that was very vocal about her experience with her mom. Very, very loving family, very close-knit family, and she was groomed online and then shamed into not sharing what was going on, the whole isolation then, and she was groomed and eventually molested by this online groomer. Yeah. And finally, it was the mother after months seeing changes and deviations from the communication style her daughter had. She became much more closed off. And so, yeah, it can happen absolutely everywhere. So that is definitely a warning to everyone. You don't have to come from a bad family.
It's a huge warning. And working with so many adolescents over the years, I don't work with as many under college age kids now just because I'm older and I'm not immersed in the culture like I was when my kids were teenagers. And I knew all the musical acts, which my kids were into Nine Inch Nails and Nirvana and, you know.
The oldies now.
The oldies, yeah. It was a different culture, but I understood it all. I'm a little bit beyond adolescent culture. But it's just something that is very, very hard for parents to monitor and understand. And then the other thing I'll mention, because this always just kind of, you know, it makes my head spin sometimes, the different level of resources in families. I have had kids, let's say early teens, in treatment for different things, who had parents that were surgeons, made nearly $1 million a year. They were in private schools. They had tutors after school. You know, when they were little, they had live-in nannies. And they just had a lifestyle where there were so many resources for them. And of course, those parents were in a situation where they could really do an adequate job for their kids. And then I literally would have kids. I had a contract with the Department of Social Services, and I would get very opposite end of the spectrum families in treatment. And, you know, literally, a mom that could not afford the $10 copay for her child's antibiotics for a severe ear infection. And I pulled out the $10 and gave it to her. And, you know, when you're working at McDonald's and another shift at Taco Bell, I think parents really are stretched sometimes. And it's just shocking the difference in outcome between the parents who are highly resourced and their reason for being in therapy is their kid is applying for top tier universities and didn't get in. And so the parents are having panic attacks and freaking out. And the family where the parents are just so exhausted, you know, they mean well, they love the kids, but they're just, you know, they're just depleted. And so I've seen the whole gamut. So I tend to have compassion for those families because I so often wish, you know, we had a better social safety net for people and, you know, and they don't have access to counselors often. They don't know what to do. They do their best, but we're just not all coming from the same playing field. I was on a psychology podcast yesterday, and there were some brilliant questions. And one of them was, you know, if you're awake at midnight and you can't sleep, what are you ruminating about? And for me, always, I wish I could have resourced my kids better. You know, I wish I could have given them more. I wish I did not have to work so much at night when they were kids. And, you know, when you're starting off as a new clinician, or I had three kids by the time I was in college and a grad student, I wasn't there enough. I tried my best. I love those kids dearly. And fortunately, nobody ran away. And I always said my bar was fairly low. I hope nobody ever gets arrested, you know. But I wasn't the parent that could fly them around the country looking for the best colleges and give them the kind of economic support that I wish I could have given them. And so I just tend to come from that place of compassion and assume that with the resources people have, most parents are doing their best. They don't all have skills. They just don't have the support network that they need. And so I'm just going with a guess in this case that there was some of that going on. Mm-hmm. And of course, there are, we talk about these other cases where you've got the psychopathic, sadistic parents that hurt their kids intentionally and abuse them and do terrible things to them. But that's sort of a different category than just people that are trying, but they're under-resourced.
You know, that empathetic parent that you're describing is me. I know it's Tony. That's when you're giving it your all. And I've had this conversation. My kids are older too. They're in their late 20s. You know, like, I wish I was more. I wish I'd been there more. Yeah. And I'm always getting a lot of grace from them, thankfully, because, you know, as a dad, they know you're doing all you can. And you will never, ever, when you care with all your heart to be the best you can for your kids, because you know, literally, it's the only thing in life that matters is how they go through life. And after you're gone, is how they're living a good, healthy life. That's all that matters. Yeah. And so you'll never be enough in your own mind. But thankfully, we have beautiful kids that give us that grace. And that's why in this case, and you make such great points, since we don't know her family, we don't know her situation. We've heard rumors, we've seen it, what we see on social media. That's why I place so much more responsibility on David's parents. Yeah. So they do have the resources. He has the resources. Why weren't you being the watchdog for people like this? You know, for someone who's going to get, because inevitably, you know, he's going to have people that are going to want to become part of that entourage. You're going to be sucked into that world they want to be part of. You know, so where are them with their awareness to parent their underage guy who's now in his early 20s, you know, from this kind of stupid. So and that's to your point, I think, is that, hey, if you do have the resources as parents, where are you? Why aren't you showing up to see these red flags when they arise, so you can prevent stupid things and happening and really tragedy for everyone?
Yeah, and how it's a very different sort of parenting that raises somebody who's that narcissistic, and we can say probably somewhat psychopathic, if not very psychopathic, and a predator. And those are, I think, the parents where, you know, it's probably easier to dissect the family and go, okay, we can see some really weird things about, because you have to feed that stuff. Mm-hmm. That's personality development. You know, it's his brain is not fully cooked at this point. But even with that, this is not normal to have a predator as your child. And that, to me, is the ultimate parent failure.
Is the culture that David was living in and really was kind of brought up in, I mean, he was online. His big thing was originally, I think, playing video games. And, you know, and it's for a lot of people that's how they're getting attention. That's how they're getting their followings, is people watching them play video games. I know. But it is certainly a big thing. That sort of culture where it's performative. They're turning it on. Their mic's on. People are watching because they like to see what they're doing on the game and what their commentary is about their game. And then when they go into a chat here or whatever over here, it's turning it on. It's turning it off at a very, very young age and different audiences in each group. They have to know who they're speaking to and how to speak to them to elicit the attention, the reaction, the following that they get. It's a very, you know, it's something that we, as an adult, I know how to do that when we go on the air and we do shows, but that's what we do. I'm an adult. This is, you know, this is the building blocks of life. You're trying to figure it out. Your brain's not fully cooked yet. This is how you're learning to stack things on top of one another as for how you're going to operate going forward. That in itself, is that a dangerous world for a young brain to be in, where it's, I can be very performative here, I can act this way, I can be this person to these people, I can be this person to those people, and I can be this other person to these people. Mm-hmm. Teens and kids, we all have done that to a certain extent. There's only, you know, certain things you say to your parents and certain things you don't. You do have that separated. But is it, I mean, are we ingraining this in such a deeper level than we used to be through social media, through training kids with their performances, if you will, with who they talk to in so many compartmentalized ways? Are we creating a little generation of psychopaths to a certain extent, or more likely to go down that road of narcissism because they have learned, I have to be this person to these people, I can be this person to those people, and that person to these people, and at the end of the day, it's all about how I feel, and I want to feel good and happy, mm-hmm. and I'll manipulate all these, and I'll pull the levers how I need to mm-hmm. get where I need to go, mm-hmm. and I'm not looking back. That's a very long question, but is that where we're sitting right now in terms of the atmosphere?
Yeah, I think so. I think there's data, I haven't looked it up recently, but that narcissism is increasing in young people, and a lot of that has to do with exactly what you're talking about. Too much attention for the wrong reasons at a very young age when their personalities are still forming and they don't develop depth. You know, yeah. It's all about what character am I playing now? And they get high off the attention and the adulation. And it's really concerning. You know, I often say we know that people in the Hollywood film industry, you find a lot more narcissism. And that's what got them there was this performative nature and this showing off for the cameras. It always just kills me, you know, things that pop up on my news feed with the, you know, the celebrity walk as they stop and they get their pictures taken and the posing and the, it just makes me cringe. It just makes me cringe because what are we celebrating in this mm-hmm. culture? You know, we make people celebrities for very foolish reasons.
It's because they're, you know, they think that that 5-second highlight reel that they're seeing from someone else is that life, and they get caught up in the disease of comparison and the cult of more.
Yeah.
And they make that their true identity that they're seeking. And to a lot of our viewers' points, yes, 100%, David is culpable for his actions and is accountable for his actions. I think with the curiosity that we're exploring is how far out does that culpability start spreading?
Yeah.
Because that's what we're really seeing. And it's definitely in the school shooter situations where parents are being more culpable. So we're kind of just exploring, mm-hmm. you know, who else is actually should have known more, could have known more. Definitely he knew better from right and wrong. But also who else in this circle, how far out does the crazy spread?
Yeah. Yeah, it would be a fascinating case study to take all that apart. And I think that's what we try to do with our conversations on this mm-hmm. show is look at all the factors. Mm-hmm. Because in truth, when you have a crime, something horrible that happens, it's usually not just one thing. Sometimes it is. And that makes me think of somebody who just had a psychotic episode mm-hmm. and did something terrible. And so the psychosis was what caused it. But that's a small percentage of crimes.
Very small.
And most of the time, it's this multifactorial stuff, and it's all the different things that led up to it. And there's a lot of factors involved.
I love that. Multifactorial.
I like what you said.
One of my favorite words.
Oh, multifactorial. You got a lot of words I love to put on. I keep writing yours down.
We'll have t-shirts soon. Don't have depth. I think that that's a very good point, and we're going to get into that here in our next segment. By the way, Siobhan's book, Nightbird, available wherever you get mm-hmm. books. Go check it out right now. It is her memoir, and it's phenomenal. Please do go and check that out. Let's continue our conversation. Prosecutors mm-hmm. allege Celeste walked into David Burke's Hollywood Hills home on April 23rd, 2025, and was never heard from again. Her dismembered remains turned up months later in his Tesla. In between, Burke reportedly made a middle of the night trip to a remote spot in Santa Barbara, performed at Coachella, you know, like you do after someone's missing or dead in your presence, released a debut album, or was about to, and launched a world tour, including a show in Minneapolis the same night her body was found in Los Angeles. The charges are brutal, but the thing that eats at people is the silence, the months of normal, the people who knew him and said nothing. And the question nobody can shake, how? And let's get into this. He was on stage in Minneapolis the night her body was found in the trunk in LA. Months of shows, smiling, performing his love songs. I think that's the interesting thing. We were just talking in our last segment about this way of thinking, about the compartmentalization that people of this age seem to have because it's just the atmosphere of which they grow up in, especially if it's mainly online, the lack of depth. When also you have the lack of depth, I think you also seem to lack the ability to understand the weight of the events that are going on around you. And I think that that's what might be what we're seeing in this case as well, where he's on stage in Minneapolis. They're finding a body in his frunk, and it's just another normal Tuesday for him. I mean, it seems that there's a level of numbness, if you will, to reality that so many young narcissists seem to have, where it's just body in your trunk is about as important to know that as the McRib is back at McDonald's. It's like it's the same level of weight, and it obviously should not be. But if you don't naturally have the ability to experience that weight, to feel the weight of those being two very different things in life, how do you develop that? I mean, that really is the recipe for a psychopath if you're not able to differentiate between something like that.
Yes.
100%.
Yeah. And it also reminded me of the amount of compartmentalization that we see with serial killers who can, you know, do something absolutely horrendous and then go to church the next day. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's like, how does a person compartmentalize like that? And yes, it's very concerning that this person can do that. I mean, just the dismemberment of a body, you know, that I always, just a little game I play in my mind when I look at criminals. It's like, can I ever imagine myself doing this, right? Can I even wrap my head around it? And I have always thought, could I kill another human being? Certainly not something I think about or fantasize about. But I think, yes, if somebody were breaking in my house, someone threatening my children, could I do something to end their life? I think I could. But would it ever occur to me to dismember their body? Ever?
Yeah.
Is that something I can even wrap my head around? Somebody who would be okay with that, whether he did it himself or had someone else do it? You're dealing with somebody with some very, very concerning personality traits,
you know,
there.
And these are really salient points to bring up, because even so, here I am, former Marine and FBI. The amount of training you go through to take someone else's life potentially is pretty robust. Going through deadly force policies, going through rules of engagement of war. And every single time you're faced with these things, you're always someone with great deep empathy, because if you're in a life of service, which is what I've been in my entire life, is you're serving and protecting, which might mean you have to do horrendous things to other human beings. Even as they're horrendous human beings, the thought and the weight of even having to do that potentially weighs on you. The counseling that you go through afterwards, I mean, I'm getting a dry mouth just thinking about it. I mean, just the tremendous impact of you as an individual, because you actually have empathy. You don't have an ability to compartmentalize it, because you are a regular human being serving other human beings, is tremendous. And so being able to do these things so compartmentalized like he did, or anyone in that circle did, whoever did this, it's absolutely insane to think that this is normal human behavior, because it's not even close. And the thing, you know, this is, we're so stuck on cults right now. It is so cult-like, you know, with the Duggars, the same kind of compartmentalization that you can completely abuse and have in your close society and system, this abuse of another human being, underage human being, and being able to try to move on from life and diminishing it and rationalizing it. It's just so, it rings so similarly to all these other horrendous crimes. And the last thing I want to say on this is, in the music industry, there are some really, I mean, there's some great people, and there's horrendous people as well. And I remember years ago, I'm a country music fan, and I'll never forget, I was so impacted by Sugarland, Jennifer Nettles. Years ago, I remember when their stage collapsed and some of their fans got injured, right? That's the last time we saw Jennifer Nettles on Sugarland for a very, very long time. It was crushing to them, the impact of even just that on their fans. That's what empathy is. Now, granted, there might have been a lot of things in there and lawsuits and all that, but I don't know. But just the impact, you saw the emotional impact of even just them performing and the injury to fans did to them personally. And here you're seeing the same thing play out with completely back-asswards results.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. 100%.
I remember that. I was working in country radio at the time.
Wasn't it impactful?
Yeah, I mean,
you saw how crushed he was.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember that. That was a while back, but yeah, I do remember that. What I'm trying to remember, or what I'm trying to think about here with David and this idea, they're bringing up in the charging docs that Burke made a late night drive to a remote area of Santa Barbara in the spring of 2025. Of course, like we've been saying, the charges include mutilation of the remains. We don't know if that drive had something to do with it. If it did, if it didn't, it's really kind of besides the point. I don't know what's more disturbing. The fact that it appears her remains were cut up out of convenience to fit into a frunk, or out of contempt because she was going to expose him. I don't know what's more disturbing here to think of how he was looking at this allegedly. You know, if he's the one who did it, this is, well, it's, we got to fit it in here, so it's basically human Tetris, you know, or it's, I hate you. You're going to expose me. And I guess this is my saw motion, I guess. Mm-hmm. Picture, you know, I don't know. I'm just trying to think of I don't know whatever somebody's doing with a saw. Maybe they're using a saw. I don't know. but that's, or maybe it's a combination of both that's going on here. But the fact that it's just such an easy lever to pull, I guess, is the most disturbing part of it, no matter what the reasoning is behind it.
Yeah, I think it can go either way. There are probably cases where it's just a matter of convenience, but still, you'd have to be pretty psychopathic to even think that way.
Yeah.
But there are certainly times when it's motivated more by rage, and the person actually gets pleasure from mutilating the body, which is also something you see with sadistic people who are serial killers. They get pleasure from the mutilation, which is, yeah, really disturbing.
That just, like, doesn't that just go against all everything of humanity? I mean, would that same person find the smell of a rotting flesh to be like, oh, fresh baked cookies? I mean, the rest of us are throwing up, you know, the second we get a whiff of something like that. They're like, ah, this is great. I mean, it seems to go so much against humanity in general.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, I'm so with you on this, Tony, because, I mean, think about this. Again, what Siobhan said is I do the same thing, and that you try to place yourself in that person's shoes, and that's how we have these deep empathies, so you can start hopefully predicting behavior to prevent horrendous things like this. And so think about this. So here they are. So let's say, let's for argument's sake, say it's an accidental death. It wasn't done out of rage. You know, so we're going to say this was an accidental death and that they had a panic escalation and this was their decision-making process. How stupid is that, right? But so think about this. If you are an empathetic human being that actually gave a rat's ass about anyone else other than yourself, and you're faced with this kind of situation, and your initial impulse is to, oh my God, a panic escalation. And you're thinking, not thinking, you say, I got to hide the body, got to get rid of the body. And you try to stuff her into a frunk of a Tesla. And we know Jennifer Coffendeffer tried this and she could see you can't fit. You got to do something to it. Here's the first thought you have is not how to make the body fit. The first impression you have, if you actually have reason, oh, this whole thing doesn't sound reasonable anyway, but is, I got to find another way instead of cutting up the body. Because if you, I mean, just, that just makes no sense to do that whatsoever, unless, to Siobhan's point, is you are actually pure psychopathic, that you have zero empathy, that this is just a tool, a screwdriver in your life that you said, I no longer have use for it. We got to get rid of it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, that's the only way you can, I think, function that way is if you're looking at that, you know, you're looking at Celeste's body as nothing more than something of value, like a lint whirler. It's like, mm-hmm. Well, I got to fit this somewhere. Well, if I take it apart, you know, then I can do that. It's a lint roller. It doesn't have feelings. I have no empathy for it. If I have to dismantle it to fit it into a bag or something, I can do it. It's not going to hurt me. But if you're having that same sort of feeling about a human being, mm-hmm. that's...
And Siobhan, so how much time would it take for the prefrontal lobe and the emotional hijacking to flood back out again? In other words, wouldn't there be enough time when you're actually thinking about how I got to now dismember this body to make it fit the frunk, where you actually, by the time you actually start getting the tools arranged and everything, if it wasn't premeditated, to say, oh, dude, that's a bad idea. See what I mean? So in other words, if it was a panic escalation to think I should do this, by the time you actually got to the point of doing it, if you weren't actually true nutter, you'd say, oh, that's not a really good idea.
That's not a good idea. It wouldn't be the automatic response unless you had your saw ready, right? It's like, you know, you've done this before, so you've got the tools and you know how to do it. Yeah, he had to ponder this a bit. And obviously, you know, is this an IQ test for, you know?
They thought this was a good idea.
Yeah, and then to just put the body in the, is it thrunk that we're calling it?
Frunk.
Okay. Put it in the frunk and then just move the car around the town. I mean, I can't wrap my head around that either. While you're going out and doing musical performances and know that your Tesla registered to you is just parked with a body in it and changing locations every so often. Yeah, this is not a thinking person.
It's like intelligent in so many ways over here, but then over here in functional ways, non-existent.
Non-existent
at all. Yeah. Let's talk about his parents a little bit. And I saw in the comments too, somebody said, hey, we were talking about her parents. Let's talk about his. Let's. Burke's parents went to court in Texas trying to block their own subpoenas. Siobhan, I mean, you've sat across from families of people accused of the worst things imaginable. When a family fights that hard to not answer questions, is that love? Is that denial? Is that something else? What do you think is going? Is it self-preservation of we're not going to get ourselves deeper into this than we already are? I mean, what the hell's going on when you're going to whatever lengths possible to not have to be accountable in any way, shape, or form when someone's life has been stolen from them and your son is the one that they're looking at?
I think all of the above from what you said, their version of love very likely is more my perfect child can't have done anything wrong. Mm-hmm. And if he did, they justify it. And they're going to do everything they can to try to, you know, keep the case from progressing and get in the way of it. But that's also the kind of parenting that produces narcissists, you know, that I will do anything to protect my kid, which I, another thing I can't wrap my head around, you know?
Yeah. Do you think, I know that reports already comes from pretty religious family and religious background. Do you think any of that played into it?
That's a really interesting factor, because I would love to know what religion looked like for them, as we've talked so much about all the different ways religion can manifest. And there are certain forms of religion, you know, I think of the prosperity gospel people, which is very much focused on, you know, getting all those blessings and earning all that money and you're special, you know. So there are narcissistic manifestations of religion. And certainly I would guess they were not Southern Baptists, you know, they were not into the service, you know, that you are here to serve and you're not special and you're a sinner and own that. My guess, it would be a very different flavor of religion. Or again, do they just really compartmentalize well?
Yeah, and what's their interpretation of what they're taken into? You know,
exactly.
I mean, as we learn more and more, as we cover so many cases of different religiosity, you have like the religion, and then you got the version of it that's being pitched within the home itself, right. And sometimes that's even far worse or more bizarre or whatever than the actual one. So, I mean, that's a question only they would know on the inside. But it certainly is an interesting angle of the recipe that made David Anthony Burke. Your questions in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. We are going to continue to try and get through them. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you're getting podcasts. You don't miss any of it. Siobhan's latest book, Nightbird, available wherever you get books. Highly recommend. Go and check this out, especially her stories of escaping extreme religiosity and surviving it and thriving and helping so many people along the way.
I'm actually listening to it for a second time.
You are.
I am. There's a lot in there. I mean, there's a lot in there. And there's because of Siobhan's upbringing, her background. You know, if we, I think in the world of us in true crime covering cults and cult mm-hmm. mentalities and everything, Siobhan's insights are really powerful yeah. in that book. It's literally, if you get it, I'm an Audible guy and listen to Siobhan yeah. go through this twice, I'm capturing more, even more a second time. So again, yeah. thanks you, Siobhan, for doing that.
Definitely. Go and check that out. Let's go to another piece of this case. Some people want to call this a tragic mistake by a kid who is in over his head. David Burke, he was 21. His fans point out he was barely an adult when all this allegedly started, but prosecutors didn't charge a scared kid. They charged a first-degree murder with special circumstances, lying in wait, financial motive, murdering a witness, a continuous S-acts. Mutilation of remains, and then there's the music. Romantic homicide. What a fitting track for a person with these accusations against him. An unreleased track reportedly naming Celeste, a video with a dark-haired girl in blood and someone going into a trunk dead, and an album called Withered. So which is it? A young man who panicked or someone who the art was warning us about? Siobhan Scott, psychotherapist and author with us today, as always, and also Robin Drake, retired FBI Special Agent, Chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program. Let's start with the music. Romantic homicide. I mean, yeah, I mean, and this is released years before all this happened. And it wasn't like it happened, then he wrote the song. So is this him predicting the future? Is this someone who is so deep into the macabre lyrics and his macabre image that somehow this ended up manifesting itself in a really, really sick way? At what point does dark art stop being expression and start being someone telling you who they really are? How much yeah. do you think of his art actually played a part in these accusations?
It alarms me. And I know that, you know, music particularly listened to by adolescents can have a dark tinge to it, sometimes very much so. And often it's just they're expressing emotions, difficult mm-hmm. emotions. But when somebody is creating this kind of material, it sets off my red flags. I mean, it just... you know, it alarms me, and particularly the prescient nature of it. Again, who can think of lyrics like I wrote some of the lyrics down in the back of my mind, I killed you and I don't even regret it. I can't believe I said it, but it's true. I hate you. That sounds a little bit like leakage to me.
The thing is, he wrote it before any of this happened.
Right, but it shows that there's a fantasy life.
Mm, okay. Yeah.
And that's the thing, is because so many awful things happen years after somebody has been thinking about it, you mm-hmm. know? And we see that so much with, like, Columbine killers and school shooters writing morbid stories about murdering people years before they picked up the gun and did it.
Yeah.
And looking back with a clinical eye, you can say, you know, somebody should have tagged this as something to ask a few more questions about or look at very closely. If I had a kid saying that stuff, I would be looking at it. You know, yeah. I would say we're going to go talk to a counselor about this, because this just makes
yes.
me very uneasy.
I mean, the fantasy angle on this is so profound. I mean, just think about this. Even when our kids are in elementary school and they go to kindergarten for the first time and the teacher asks them to draw a picture of your home, things that come back a little different, a little deviant, they get calls to home, say, what's going on here? You know, right. You know, there's a lot of wellness checks that happen when kids start articulating through art what their home life is like, what life is like, because again, it's not past as prologue, but at the same time though, that's sort of the first indicators coming out like this. And as we're discussing, it's talking about that fantasy aspect of this, it really reminds me of what serial killers do too. I mean, it's about
fantasization.
You combine that kind of sick fantasization in an escalation towards not being enough just to think about it, not just enough to write about it. They have to actually act on it. And then when you combine that with high level psychopathy, oh my God, it's a recipe for really bad things happening.
Yeah. And the Sandy Hook killer in third grade
yes.
created a little book about murder. And actually, in the book, the child killed his mother. which is ultimately what ended up happening. Nobody tagged it. In fact, I think the school had it printed off because the kids were all writing little books. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they copied it and made a little binder, and here was his little book. And it was filled with death and killing and even killing mother, which is ultimately what he ended up doing. That was where his brain was at third grade. So I tend to take those things seriously. Absolutely. Someone wrote a clinical book. This has been about 20 years ago. I don't recall the name of it, but she was writing about trauma and this exact topic and how it shows up in art and the way it leaks out. Yes. And she did a little mini analysis of Stephen King and what she was speculating his childhood had been like and the kind of trauma that he must have lived through in order to create the dark stories, you know, that he created, and that this stuff does live in our head. So
great analogy. Yeah. And it made me think, I got to make sure I use my daughter's other mug. I got a mug that we made from her art in kindergarten. It's so sweet. It's safe. It's flowers. It's nice. Yeah. So anyway, thank God. Right.
Yeah.
And what is she now? She's a nurse.
Yeah.
You guys don't want to see the books I wrote in elementary school.
They weren't quite that dark, but they were dark. I will say, but it wasn't like, oh, let's. I think it wasn't about killing anybody. I don't think there might have been a murder or two in there.
Oh my
but it was more from what, like, I grew up watching Rescue 911, Unsolved Mysteries in 2020. You know, these are the things that I was more interested in than watching reruns of Full House.
Tony, as part of your life arc, I know we're digressing here, but then what do you do now in the world of radio that you fell in love with at 14 when Todd hired you?
Yeah.
Is you do ghost stories, you do true crime, which is it's your outlet for all those things.
It ended up making a career out of the shit I wrote books about in third grade. I really literally, because I have like some ghost ones I wrote about haunted bunk beds and things of that nature based on unsolved mysteries. I still have them, and it's kind of funny because, the things I pretended to do as a child, I do in real life now. Like, I've monetized them. I found ways to
it's
make it.
Healthy.
It's amazing that you can even do that these days. You know, I mean, I never thought like I'm going to make a living doing this stuff. Let's talk for a second about some of them. I mean, those lyrics, song lyrics are typically things people relate to, things that, you know, you sing along with because it's meaningful to you in your life. I mean, when you're jamming out to those lyrics, like you said, they're like, in the back of my mind, I killed you and I didn't even regret it. I can't believe I said it, but it's true. I hate you. Mm-hmm. That's a red flag, I think, really to anybody who's jamming out to that to a certain extent. I mean, there's all sorts of music, but I mean, that's dark. That's really dark. And that's not just your typical I'm angry song. That's like calculated killer type lyrics.
Yeah, very much. Very much. And we're all influenced by the media we consume. It may be under conscious awareness. But I mean, if we've all been inspired by a piece of music, by a play, by a film that makes us feel good, you know, we integrate good values, we become better people. Well, it goes the other direction too.
Yeah.
So I'm cautious.
It's
about
also, you know, when you think about the circle and the entourage that was part of this with him, because the stats and averages and is saying this is, you couldn't dismember a body solo in most of these cases. And so when you think about the cover he might have been getting, or at least supported by, when you're actually creating content like that, who does it attract? Mm-hmm. People of like mind. You know, they very flock good to like ideas. And so when you get caught up in the culture of, hey, we're all thinking the same, we must be right, and you have that personal confirmation bias coming from your sycophants that you're surrounded by because you're all believing in the same stuff that you're spewing out, it is a continued escalation into disaster.
Yeah.
How much of his music do you think is going to end up on trial here? Where, I mean, I'm looking at some of it here. I mean, what do you think is going to make it into court? There's also the leaked unreleased song that allegedly is from him called Celeste. I mean, this doesn't necessarily go into the murder end of things, but there are SA charges here that are going on. Some of the lyrics, "Oh Celeste, my girl with my name tattooed on her chest, smell her on my clothes like cigarettes. I hear her voice each time I take a breath. I'm obsessed, afraid you'll only love me when undressed." There you go. That's going to that's not going to be looked forward or looked favorably in front of a jury. "But you look so damn gorgeous in that dress. Missing you so much makes me depressed." Well, there we go. That kind of seems to establish that there's quite a relationship going on there. In a Rehab music video, he references bloody sandals, bodies stacked on top of another, you know, like you do in a good pop hit. Remember all those Backstreet Boys about the bodies being stacked. And then you got other scattered lines and tracks, "Poison, bleed out, drink and drive." I mean, it's like, all you got to do is look at his track listing to get an idea of what the hell's going on up in that head, it seems. I mean, how
can you be convicted on art? I think
can you be convicted on art? Do you think that these things? I mean, granted, they are art. Some of these things were written before this happened. Some appear to might possibly have been after. How do you think if those things make it into a courtroom, a jury's gonna relate to it?
It would be my guess that would really influence the jury. And I don't know enough about how judges make their decisions on what they allow in and what they don't.
Let's just say it gets in, just for the sake of the argument. Yeah,
I have to say it would influence me, you know, just about again, what kind of fantasies does this person have and what does it mean about their character? Mm-hmm. And it's dark and creepy and relevant. I mean, I'm always the person that's in favor, not that anybody cares about my opinion about it, but let everything in. I mean, you know, if there's relevant evidence, let it in. But I understand that judges work within other parameters and therefore choose not to do that.
And it definitely seems to be one of those cases where life imitates art. Mm-hmm. I mean, just the congruence between the accusations and what the lyrics are is creepy. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just, I mean, it's like Taylor Swift. I mean, she writes about all her ex-boyfriends. I mean, that's the same thing. I mean, a lot of things originated from true stories of our own lives. And I think if they can draw that parallel, I think it, again, that's why we've got to ask Bob Mata and Eric about this on the show, just kind of see as a lawyer what they think is going to be admissible or not admissible. What I would think, because there's such a close parallel. I mean, what's the difference between admitting this as opposed to admitting a text message? I mean, I'm curious about it too. Mm-hmm.
Prosecutors allege a specific financial motive as well, that Celeste's existence threatened Burke's career, basically insinuating that if she were to come out and say, "Hey, by the way, you're this much older than me and I'm a child and you're having this kind of relationship with me," that might not work out so well in the public eye. And it threatened that career. And that was the reason she was allegedly killed. When protecting a brand becomes more important than the actual child's life, is that something a person arrives at suddenly, Siobhan? Or is there wiring that's already in place there, in your opinion?
Yeah, there's a lot of distorted thinking going on with that. And yeah, we can probably say that the wiring was off for David Burke. It's, again, hard to fathom how you would value your brand and your celebrity and your money more than the life of another person. But that is what a psychopath does. Machiavellianism. It's always about how can I use people, manipulate, and get ahead.
And how insecure are you that you think one teenager could undermine your entire brand? Or how bad do you think you actually are behind the scenes that they actually could? So it's either you're way overthinking what a 13-year-old or a teenager could do to your personal brand, unless you did really abhorrent things you know you shouldn't have done. So it's either one or the other. Either you're a complete idiot or a double-down idiot for doing things that she could. See what I mean? It's just like you're in the wrong no matter what, big time.
Mm-hmm. And no one, I guess that's the other part of this whole thing, is there seems to be a lot of people that were in this orbit. I'm going to guess a lot of them got deals, and that's why we haven't seen any other arrests as of right now. That's more of a legal question, but I'm wondering if that's what's going on. And I do wonder, I mean, how likely do you think it is, Siobhan, and we kind of talked about this earlier, that everyone in the orbit of David had no idea that this girl was the age that she was. Was David the only one who knew her true age? Or do you think there's a world in which David didn't even know how old she was? To me, that's quite a stretch, but mm-hmm. I'm throwing it out there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a stretch. I think anybody who was intimately involved with these two would have been able to tell that this girl was not over 18. I mean, she you know, she was an early adolescent. She looked early adolescent. She spoke like a young teenager from the bit of video that we've mm-hmm. seen of her. I think people were aware and just, you know, he was the man. He was the one that they were sucking up to, and nobody was going to criticize it.
No kidding, because I've been around people that were a lot of celebrity types, and the amount of care that them and their entire team put into who they allow close to them, who they allow to take photos with. I'm like, so when I was in the FBI years and years ago in New York City, we'd have the Goodwill games. And I remember, I'll never forget this, and I'm so sorry, this is a me moment, but it's the illustrated point.
We love them.
So Shaquille O'Neal, I met him because he came through the Waldorf Astoria, the Goodwill games are going on. And I remember he had his entourage and he loved FBI guys. And so we're there doing protection around him, for him. And I remember I'm standing with him, which is hilarious to begin with, right? And I remember a young woman came up and asked for his autograph, and he's very gracious, given an autograph. And then she said, "Can I take a photo?" And he goes, no, I don't do photos with you. And I was like, and I looked at him after, I said, "Why not?" And he goes, "That's just danger waiting for a place." I mean, they were so careful about who to take photos with, who he allowed into that close circle to vet them for any potential like this. So making the point here, how blind was his entire entourage, parents, friends, sycophants, I don't care who it is, that they allowed someone this underage without questioning her? I mean, they didn't even ask the question, so they had to have known, or they're completely blind. And so that's why I keep going back to that culpability. Who in this entourage is culpable for all this? I think there's a lot. And to your point also earlier, Tony, we might not see other charges yet because maybe everyone flipped on him.
That's what I'm thinking. I mean, honestly. Yeah. I mean, I don't know why there wouldn't be other charges by now if others are going to be charged, or if this is why, you know, you have a literal federal indictment against the guy. Like, I'm guessing it's pretty tight what they're bringing. At least I hope it is. I hope it's not another Diddy, you know.
Yeah, and to everyone's point in the comments as well, I don't think they're going to have to rely on song lyrics. I think it's going to be a small part of a big hole about what they have on him. I think there's going to be a lot of testimonials. I think there's going to be a lot of digital evidence because you got a lot of underage people on their texting, on their Google machines, you know, all these things. I think there's going to be a lot.
Yeah, I think the lyrics are icing on the cake at this point, quite honestly.
Besides a Tesla giving up all the details, I think that Tesla's got a lot to say.
The winner in this is Elon Musk, and your Tesla will tell on you. You should understand that when you buy one. Fascinating conversation, as always. Thank you guys for your questions and comments. Keep dropping them. We read them, and we'll try to get to them, too, in other videos on Substack and YouTube. Be sure to make your comments there. Siobhan Scott's latest book, Nightbird, available wherever you get books. Go and check it out. I highly recommend it. Also, Robin Drake's latest, It's Not All About Me, also available wherever books are sold. Go and check all of those out. All right. Until next time, for Todd, for Robin, for Siobhan, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Third Love makes bras that actually fit, so they know this. If your bra feels uncomfortable, the problem isn't your body, it's your bra. Third Love designs for comfort first. Soft fabrics, support that doesn't dig, pinch, or slip. Bras that feel good and look good under everything you wear. Shop Third Love and explore over 60 sizes, including AA through H, and half cup sizes you won't find anywhere else. Get $15 off your first purchase at thirdlove.com with code PODCAST15.
Here's what happened when one journalist reported on DEI programs.
I decided to just focus on the University of Michigan. I obtained internal documents that showed that the school had spent about $250 million on DEI programs. I spent 2 weeks in Ann Arbor talking to everybody I could find. The unintended consequences of these programs, they had sort of left everybody dissatisfied. And this expensive machinery the school had built just imploded. If you're a journalist, you are not on anyone's team. All you're trying to do is figure out as many of the facts as you can gather. The facts are going to guide you to where the story lands. You're not taking sides. I'm Nick Confessori. I'm an investigations reporter for the New York Times.
Journalists like Nick follow the facts wherever they lead. They go where news breaks, get answers firsthand, and publish what they find. That's fact-based reporting. Seek it out if you don't already.